Gideon Williams out of New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us for another debate. I'm Marcia Hashemi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا ادعوا ربكم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel denies entrance to Palestinians with cancer through a Gaza checkpoint, despite announcing last week it would allow such travel in life-threatening cases. And India reports it's the lowest daily rise in new COVID infections since mid-April, the country's total cases reaching 28 million. World News, I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iran saying key issues still need to be resolved in the Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh made a comment in his weekly press conference. He said that making decisions in key fields require precision and time. Khatibzadeh noted that Tehran's main goal is to support its national interests, saying it's now the time for the U.S. to make a definite political decision. He once again stated that Iran will return to full compliance with the accord after verifiable removal of all sanctions that the U.S. has imposed since pulling out of the deal in 2018. Khatibzadeh said that Iran has been moving in the same direction it took since the very beginning of the nuclear talks. Israel has denied entry of Gaza cancer patients for treatment through a checkpoint despite calls by human rights organizations. Israel had blocked the Erez checkpoint completely during its recent aggression against the besieged Palestinian territory. The blockade kept patients with urgent medical needs waiting for permission to leave the territory. After a ceasefire last Friday, Tel Aviv announced it will now allow the entry of people needing life-saving treatment. However, based on reports, it's only allowed the entry of people needing to reach intensive care units by ambulance. Now, this is while several human rights organizations made an appeal last Wednesday calling the blockade an extremely unreasonable move. Now, let's go to Gaza City. Ashraf Shanner, correspondent there. Ashraf, what's the problem with this? They first announced they would allow this to happen, and now they refrain from doing that?
Well, Bahrou, is this just another example of the brutality of the Israeli regime, the brutality of the leaders in Tel Aviv? They've been doing this for years. In Gaza alone, over 1,100 Palestinians have died as Tel Aviv continuously refused to allow patients to exit Gaza for any life-saving treatment since 2007. Now, with the issue of cancer patients, it's one of the worst things you can imagine. I personally lost my dad to cancer 2 years ago. My sister has two types of cancer. I have friends who died of cancer. This is really emotional for me. And I have to tell you this, the Israeli regime, the intelligence officers, Israeli security forces, they not only refuse to let patients exit Gaza, especially cancer patients, they also refuse to allow in chemotherapy equipment to enter Gaza and all sorts of needed tools to treat cancer patients. They also arrest cancer patients and deny them treatment inside Israeli jails and detention centers. They also arrest those accompanying the patients. Not only that, they blackmail them into working as spies for Israeli agencies.
Do we know how many patients we have that need some, they're in critical situation and they need some treatment? And if they are allowed, finally, by Israel, where would they receive such treatment?
Well, if Israel allows them to exit Gaza through the Israeli-controlled crossing in the northernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, which is actually Beit Hanun area, it's a Beit Hanun crossing. Israel created that crossing to make life miserable for Palestinians, not since 2007. I grew up entering that crossing in Gaza when going to Jerusalem al-Quds, going to Bethlehem, going to Nablus. So for a Palestinian in Gaza to reach anywhere outside the Gaza Strip, we're talking about from the northern part. So Gaza has two crossing points, Rafah in the south, controlled by the Egyptians, and all the way in the north, controlled by the Israeli regime. So for them, most likely in Al-Quds, in Al-Maghased Hospital, or Al-Mutaleh Hospital in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. And you can't imagine how difficult it is. You know what they do? For example, they give the patient an exit permit. Well, that patient cannot walk or cannot drive himself or on a wheelchair. So they give that patient an exit permit, but they deny the one who accompanies him a permit. So the patient is stuck at their cross point waiting for someone, a miracle from God to reach the hospital.
Something they just want to show off and pretend that they are helping, but actually they are not helping anyone. Okay, hopefully that will come to an end. Ashraf Shanner, our correspondent live in Gaza City. Now, days after a ceasefire put a stop to Israel's incursion on the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, protests against the regime are still going on all around the world, including in Pakistan. The rallies that began in the country's south and north are now spilling over to the country's northwestern border region with Afghanistan. Javed Rana has more from Islam.
A massive public outpouring in Peshawar, the regional capital of Pakistan's northwestern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Anger is boiling in Pakistan like elsewhere in the Muslim world over Israel's atrocities during the 11-day long conflict, which the United Nations said could amount to war crimes. Pakistanis are particularly furious over Israeli troops for desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem Al-Quds, Islam's third holiest site. Similar protests have also been held in major cities against Israel's plans to evict Palestinians from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds.
We have a very deep-seated love for Palestine. It is a part of our belief system to live and die for Palestine. And that is why such a huge number of people have turned up in this protest.
The ongoing protests are mounting increasing pressure on Pakistani government to help Palestinian militarily to prevent another Israeli aggression. Pakistan has backed Turkey's demand to set up an international protection mechanism to prevent Israel's aggression in future, although the scope and reach of such a mechanism have yet to be established. Analysts believe that some non-Arab countries can form a joint military coalition in not-so-distant future.
We want the government to support us. We will go to Palestine to defend our brothers. But if Israel fights with us, then we will hit back.
More mass anti-Israel protests are expected in the coming weeks and months as different opposition parties are planning demonstrations across Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The Yemeni army says it has launched a fresh retaliatory drone strike against targets inside Saudi Arabia. Spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Saria, announced the attack in a Twitter post. He said the drone hit the King Khalid Airbase near the Saudi city of Khamis Mashait in Nasir province. The kingdom and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have been killed. Yemen says the retaliatory attacks will continue until Riyadh stops its aggression and blockade. Yemeni armed forces have launched a new large-scale operation in the Jazan region on the Saudi's southern borders. The army says the forces have taken control of large areas and captured dozens of military camps deep inside the Saudi soil.
The Yemeni army has carried out another successful massive operation that was announced by the spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Saria, who described the offensive as a major victory in the southern Saudi Jazan region.
There is no doubt that this operation will affect the Saudi enemy severely, especially as it comes at a time when the Marib fronts and other fronts are under much pressure. Thus, these back-to-back victories confirm Saudi Arabia's inability to achieve any of the goals declared at the beginning of the war. The Saudi-led coalition failed in the military confrontation, while the Yemeni army continued to significantly improve its capabilities.
The spokesman stated that this operation comes in response to the escalation of Saudi Arabia's war and its ongoing siege on Yemen. Military experts said this victory could be part of the ongoing talks as it will push Riyadh further to accept a fair political solution.
Every military operation, including the Jizan operation, has political dimensions. Saudi Arabia is an arrogant country that believes its capabilities and the support it receives by Britain and America will help it achieve something in the field. Today, the Yemeni army proved that it is capable of gaining military control and that the battle has moved deep inside Saudi soil. Saudi Arabia is forced to move forward a political solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Airbase in Azir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia. And that is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliation. Military attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Now we'll get some COVID news. India has recorded a downward trend in its coronavirus infections for the second consecutive day, and this after experiencing a steep rise for weeks. The health ministry has announced 152,000 new cases in a day. That pushes the case load to 28 million, just behind the U.S. Health officials also reported 3,000 deaths in the same period, slightly lower than the previous day. India's overall fatalities are approaching 330,000. The three-digit cases and deaths are attributed to the spread of an aggressive new wave of the virus in the South Asian country in the past weeks. The World Health Organization says that Indian variant has been already found in more than 53 countries, calling it a matter of global concern. Now, from New Delhi, let's bring in our correspondent, Munawwar Zaman. Munawwar, we've been talking about this, and should we be now hopeful that things are coming under control of the government and that we'll have better days in terms of coronavirus actually getting under control in India?
Well, of course, we should always be optimistic, because when we had the first wave, we did whatever there was possibility of doing, and that was controlled somehow. The COVID-19 pandemic was able to get being controlled in the region, but the second wave was something which was not expected to be much harder than what they anticipated, because everything was being taken for granted when the first wave and its control was successful. We can be optimistic related to the COVID second wave, which is showing some signs of retreat over the last couple of days, or perhaps 3 or 4 days. There is a slight change in the trend if we are to believe the government figures. But many surveys and suggest reports and surveys are there on the social domain, on the international domain, which believe the India's overall caseload could be as much as 40 million. I mean, that's what 40 million, not 40 million, 300 to 400 million. That's what many surveys suggest. Uh-huh. And the death toll could be as much as 4 billion. These are the surveys and reports that are being circulated online. And I don't know how much authentic they are, but what I've seen on the ground is, of course, to some extent, a matter of great concern, because rural parts of the country are extremely reeling, and there we do not have healthcare facilities. We have a vaccination shortage there. Of course, there is a problem with the mindset of the people. If somebody is infected with COVID pandemic, people have a mindset they don't touch the dead bodies. And we have seen in the recent weeks that some 250 or more dead bodies were seen floating in the Ganges River. So, of course, there is certain optimism, and at the same time, we should not lower the guards. We should not stop following the standard operating procedures, and we should also adhere by government guidelines. And the good news from the last couple of days is that India has started opening gradually. Mm-hmm. Some states have given a relaxation in the guidelines, for example, opening up the factories and industries. So the whole process is going to start with a gradual procedure. But yes, of course, the neighboring state of Uttar Pradesh and states such as Union Territory, actually Delhi as the capital, has started considering a lockdown ease from next week. Jammu and Kashmir has started easing lockdown, and Punjab has started easing some restrictions. But yes, of course, it is gradually opening up, but we should also be cautious about the new strains that are being discovered in India, which is the black fungus and the white fungus. There are three categories of these new variants, which is becoming a biggest area of concern for scientists and health authorities, and they are getting a difficult task of containing this new epidemic of black fungus. First, it was the COVID, which there was a vaccine. People started thinking that it's over now and we can get away with it. But now this new fungus issue is becoming a headache for the government and the health experts. Back to you, Bearholz.
Okay, hopefully that issue will also be tackled. Thank you very much for that update, Munawwar Zaman in New Delhi. Now, China has reported new COVID-19 cases in the country's south, prompting the authorities to cancel numerous flights. Health officials registered 27 new infections in Guangdong province, 20 of them being locally originated. Officials say that 7 cases came from abroad. Over 500 flights at Guangzhou's international airport were canceled on Monday. Officials are using additional precautions, such as proof of negative COVID tests for people traveling to and from the city. They've also implemented restrictions on movement in certain neighborhoods. China has logged 91,000 infections since the start of the pandemic. Total fatalities from the disease in China remain at 4,636. Nigerian police say that gunmen have kidnapped scores of children from an Islamic seminary in the country's Niger state. The authorities say that some 200 children were at the school when it came under attack. It's not immediately clear how many of the students have been abducted. That happened the day after 14 university students were released in northwestern Nigeria after 40 days in captivity. Kidnappings for ransom are common in Nigeria's northwestern region. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight.
Tens of thousands of protesters poured on Saturday, 29th of May, onto the streets of Brazil's largest cities to demand the impeachment of President Jair Bolsonaro over his catastrophic response to a coronavirus pandemic that has claimed nearly 500,000 Brazilian lives. The demonstrators turned out in more than 200 cities and towns for what is the biggest anti-Bolsonaro mobilization since Brazil's COVID outbreak began. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's correspondent in Rio de Janeiro, Tom Phillips. The piece is titled, Tens of Thousands of Brazilians March to Demand Bolsonaro's Impeachment. Tens of thousands of protesters poured on Saturday, 29th of May, onto the streets of Brazil's largest cities to demand the impeachment of President Jair Bolsonaro over his catastrophic response to a coronavirus pandemic that has claimed nearly 500,000 Brazilian lives. The demonstrators turned out in more than 200 cities and towns for what is the biggest anti-Bolsonaro mobilization since Brazil's COVID outbreak began. Today is a decisive milestone in the battle to defeat Bolsonaro's genocidal administration, said Silvia de Mendonça, a 55-year-old, a civil rights activist from Brazil's Unified Black Movement, as she led a column of protesters through Rio de Janeiro's dilapidated city center. Osvaldo Bazzani da Silva, a 48-year-old hairdresser who lost his younger brother to COVID-19, said, We can't lose any more Brazilian lives. We need to hit the streets every single day until this government falls. In Rio, many marchers carried homemade placards remembering loved ones they have lost to an epidemic that has killed nearly 460,000 Brazilians, the world's second largest official death toll after the United States. I'm here in his memory, said Luis Dantas, an 18-year-old teenager clutching a photograph of his grandfather, Sebastião, who died in February, aged 75. The culprit has a first and second name, Luis Dantas claimed in reference to his country's far-right president, who has repeatedly trivialized the coronavirus as a little flu, and sabotaged containment efforts such as social distancing or lockdowns. I want justice, the 18-year-old teenager added, shedding tears as he spoke. Irene Grether, a 69-year-old psychoanalyst who was also at the demonstration, said two relatives had died as a result of the Brazilian government's inaction. This government is more dangerous than the virus, she said, as thousands of protesters gathered near a statue remembering the anti-slavery resistance leader, Zumbi dos Palmares. Irene Grether's niece, a 46-year-old economist called Ana Paula Carvalho, said she believed Jair Bolsonaro should be brought before the International Criminal Court in The Hague, Netherlands, for crimes against the Brazilian people. He fosters death and destruction, she said. Bolsonaro is a Brazilian tragedy. President Jair Bolsonaro has defended his response to the pandemic, claiming his dogged opposition to lockdown is designed to protect Brazilian livelihoods and jobs. But Carvalho said that by allowing the uncontrolled spread of the coronavirus and failing to acquire sufficient vaccines, President Bolsonaro has destroyed the economy as well as lives. Today, the Brazilian people have a choice between dying from the coronavirus or from hunger, she said. Saturday's demonstrations, which also took place in major cities including Sao Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, Belo Horizonte, Recife, and the capital Brasilia, as well as scores of smaller towns and cities, come from Bolsonaro at arguably his lowest ebb since he took office in January of 2019. Opinion polls suggest growing anger at the right-wing populist handling of the COVID pandemic, with 57% of the Brazilian population now backing Bolsonaro's impeachment. A congressional inquiry is currently dissecting Bolsonaro's calamitous response to the public health crisis, with damaging revelations about his government's conduct being broadcast each night on the news. Bolsonaro appears particularly rattled by the re-emergence of his political rival, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, the former leftist president who looks poised to challenge him for the presidency in next year's election. Lula da Silva, whose political rights were recently restored, has said he has no doubt the Brazilian people would free themselves from Bolsonaro in 2022. He could have avoided half of these deaths, Lula da Silva said of Bolsonaro's reaction to the COVID pandemic. Roberto Anderson, a 67-year-old university professor and environmentalist who was at Saturday's march and demonstration, said he felt encouraged by the large turnout that suggested the tide was finally turning against Brazil's radical right-wing president. Roberto Anderson, the university professor, said, "People are waking up now. Lots of people who voted for Bolsonaro are now wobbling, and the politicians who support him still are opportunists. The moment they see the people organizing, they will switch sides too."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
Really sad to see so many Palestinians have been killed in the latest Israeli war on the Gaza Strip. Hi, I'm Kavit Apley. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, the military cost of Israel's onslaught on the Gaza Strip. From the price of the bombs that were fired from the Iron Dome missile system to other military hardware. We'll also compare that to the military cost of the Palestinian resistance factions. Who do you think came out on top? Next, we will take a look at the economic hit due to the war. Israel was just growing out of the COVID-19 pandemic. It had mass vaccinations, hoping to get its economy going again. Then, because of this, did investments fall? What about business closures? Things that maybe Israel did not consider in its calculations. Then comes a call from the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. A boycott of firms complicit in Israel's occupation is what the BDS movement called. Did their voices get heard? Did the international community react? Things that we'll be looking at.
It was a brutal war. Israel bombed Gaza. There were civilian casualties. On the Israeli side, 11 were killed. On the Palestinian side, about 300. Disproportionate. But another area was also uneven. Rockets from the Gaza Strip, over 4,000, disrupting Israeli lives who ran for cover. Businesses closed across the occupied territories. Israel had hoped to recover lost business from the pandemic, but those numbers would be scrapped for now.
It's a bit stressful, this situation. We are not used to it here in Tel Aviv.
Had Israel thought through the economic risks?
We are privileged to have with us today for this segment a very special guest. He is none other than the former UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Palestine, Richard Falk. He has written for publications including The Nation, Huffington Post, and Al Jazeera. Richard, thank you so much for joining us here on Economic Divide. This war that Israel has waged on the Gaza Strip involving the shelling and the bombing is costing Israel a lot. First, the military cost. Iron Dome interceptors between $50,000 to $100,000 each. Palestinian factions have fired over 4,000 missiles so far. A lot of money trying to intercept these missiles from that Israel is trying to intercept, along with other military costs. What do you make of that? Do you think this is affecting Israel's economy?
Well, I think it's a minor effect as far as the encounter is concerned. It certainly has an impact on Israel, but Israel, I don't think, will feel the pressure of the economic consequences of this upsurge of violence as much as the political consequences, which are much more serious for them. They have always emphasized in these military operations against Gaza that they're also field testing new weapon systems that they then are able to sell at a premium to other countries.
Okay, thank you so much. We appreciate that, Richard Falk talking there. And, of course, Richard Falk is the former UN Special Rapporteur for the Palestinian territories. We appreciate his comments. When Israel decided to harshly crack down on Palestinians who wanted to pray at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, which led eventually to the Gaza War, did it calculate the economic losses of its offensive? Well, here's a snapshot of how Israel was doing up until the war. Now, as you can see, for the years 2018 and 2019, which is coming up shortly, well, there was modest growth there, 3.5% and 3.4%. But then came the dip, the GDP contraction of over 20% for the year 2020. Economic growth expectations were high for 2021 due to the vaccination of more than 50% of its population. But 6.3%, that was the projection. That did not come into fruition, however. Now, the unemployment figure in Israel was shockingly high relative to the GDP contraction. Prior to the COVID-19, the unemployment rate, which was reported at that time, as we can see over here, was 30%, a little over 30% prior to the pandemic, but it hit over 30% last year, counting the ones that were on furlough. After the vaccination program, it decreased down to 16.7% for the month of February. Now let's take a look at the poverty rate in Israel. The economic fallout from COVID-19 had a devastating impact on many sectors across the board. Now, the rate stood at 30% at the end of last year, which also is reflective of an inequality problem that Israel is facing. These are things that not many know about. So putting these economic figures next to each other, it's easy to see that Israel's economy was not even doing that great going into the war. Well, here is the most shocking fact about Israel's economy, and it's something that Israel always seems to boast about, that it's doing well, that it has an advanced economy, but it couldn't be further from the truth.
We also discussed Israel's unique and frankly deeply troubling predicament as a democracy grappling with a pandemic in the context of a constitutional crisis that has left the political system virtually paralyzed.
Okay. That's a presenter from I-24. It's an Israeli channel. But let's review what he said, because it's very important. And again, it's something that's under the radar. It's not really covered that much. First of all, at the time the COVID-19 hit Israel, Israel suffered from a recession. So that's number one. Then you had business closures that happened as a result of that. Of course, the pandemic led to business closures. And it also suffered from unemployment. These are all economic factors that has constituted to Israel's economic crisis. Now, Israel has had elections four times for the prime minister position, but without a clear winner for that post. So therefore, it is suffering from a constitutional crisis, one which has not only left the political system paralyzed, but has affected its budget and subsequent spending.
As a result, Israel, incredibly, has had to contend with a pandemic without a state budget. Believe it or not, we're still running on a budget conceived in 2017, and the current government is on the verge of collapse because it has failed to pass a budget for the remainder of 2020, let alone 2021.
Well, you can see how bad Israel is doing. I mean, no budget for 2020 and no budget for the year 2021. Well, how can it operate then? I mean, how can it spend money? How did things get so bad? I mean, how did Israel slide to what many have called both an economic and political bankruptcy?
Above all, Prime Minister Netanyahu, I mean, he takes the responsibility. In the last years, it's not really governments, because Netanyahu does whatever he wants. He really became a one-show man, for the good and for the bad, and all the responsibility is on his shoulder. For the good and for the bad, the good things that happened to Israel, the bad things that happened to Israel, they are right now all Netanyahu, because he doesn't let anyone else really to run any kind of independent policy.
Keyword there, independent. Okay, that was Gideon Levy, author and journalist. Let's get some sense of why Israel then would wage a war at this point in time with an economy that is surely not on stable footing. We're going to bring in Blaine Coleman in a second. He's an activist for the BDS movement into this segment. He's also a commentator at public meetings at the Ann Arbor City Council and at the Central Student Government at the University of Michigan. But before we bring him in, we're going to show you in action at the Ann Arbor Human Rights Commission taking a stance on the U.S. military aid to Israel, which gives us a sense where he comes from when it comes to Israel.
Up to now, no American city council has passed a resolution to cut off military aid to Israel. And asking to cut off military aid to Israel is a very, very modest proposal, considering how they've used that military aid to massacre many, many Palestinians. I don't have to tell you that Israel shot down thousands of human rights demonstrators who are Palestinian in Gaza, who are unarmed human rights demonstrators. Israel shot them down.
Okay, there you saw him in action. Well, let me bring him in and ask him about what he thinks in terms of the war. Blaine, we're looking at the economy of Israel, the fighting with Hamas, weakening Israel's economic growth for Q1, and may dent 2021's Israel's economy for the year 2021 in terms of the growth. Now, at this point, Israel's economy has contracted by 6.5% for the first quarter. The Central Bureau of Statistics said this could curb its economic recovery from the pandemic. Has Israel figured this into its cost when it waged a war?
Well, you know, I don't read Haaretz and Jerusalem Post and the Zionist press, so I don't know what they're thinking, but I imagine that they have figured all of those economic costs in. I can tell you that apartheid South Africa had all kinds of costs like that while it was, you know, wreaking havoc across Africa in the 1970s and 80s. And I imagine their economy contracted a bit. This is not what doomed apartheid South Africa, the dollars and cents. What doomed them is the political cost of the whole world just hating apartheid South Africa for being a violent, racist state. And that is the only reason they couldn't carry on, not the money part. Israel is now in the same area of its political decline. They can replace the money, they can have their economy contract, uncontract, that's not their problem. Their problem is the world is more growing to hate them, and especially the United States public is more growing to hate them for their racism. Does Israel still have a majority of the U.S. public behind it? Yeah, but a sizable, disgusted minority of the U.S. public really hates the racism and the apartheid of Israel.
Well, we're headed for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. Our in-depth section is coming up, and we have more guests joining us to break down the huge economic gamble that Israel took when it assaulted Gaza.
The war on Gaza came with a cost in more ways than one. First, the military cost. The cost of Iron Dome's interceptors, estimated to be anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 each. This is while cost of rockets fired by Hamas, somewhere between $300 to $800 each. The difference in cost, huge. But what's more important, Hamas rockets draining tens of millions of dollars from the Israeli economy at little cost to themselves. The Iron Dome is estimated to have intercepted around 4,000 rockets at a cost of $200 million. Israel says its military inflicted a heavy toll, but did it achieve its aim? Victory is hard to measure. In light of the military costs, there are those who profit from such wars. Above all, the weapon manufacturers provide the Israeli military with weaponry, namely the U.S. The U.S. provides Israel with around $4 billion in military aid. The catch? Israel needs to buy all of its military arsenal from the U.S. Is that why the U.S. was not so quick to lend a hand in stopping this war?
As we've said before, Israel has the right to defend itself.
I want to read something a mother named Iman in Gaza wrote 2 days ago. She said, quote, "Tonight, I put the kids to sleep in our bedroom so that when we die together." And no one would live to mourn the loss of another.
There is no equivalence between a terrorist group indiscriminately firing rockets at civilians and a country defending its people.
The statement broke me a little more because of my country's policies and funding will deny this mother's right to see children live, her own children live, without fear and to grow old without painful trauma and violence. We must condition aid to Israel on compliance with international human rights and end the apartheid. We must, with no hesitation, demand that our country recognize the unconditional support of Israel has enabled the erasure of Palestinian life and the denial of the rights of millions of refugees.
Mm.
Now is the time to take a look at some of the other headlines that are making its way into our radar in the info news section. The first item that we're going to take a look at is something we've looked at in the past week, and it concerns the crypto market. There was a crypto crash. Bitcoin, Ethereum to have plunged. This market is not going through a good times right now. Nearly $1 trillion in losses. $1 trillion. It's a little bit over $2 trillion market share that it has, the crypto market. Now, the sharp drop came on top of news that China's banning cryptocurrencies, and it's going to crack down hard on where mining is occurring. Also, there's news coming from the Fed that's going to crack down on some of the crypto houses, and that, again, is not good news, which has led to the drop in the crypto prices. Next up, inflation. Inflation is plaguing the economic growth. Now, the rise in inflation has actually hit the U.S. economy in terms of it trying to progress and to come out of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, because of that, investors are cutting down on their portfolios, so they're not going to invest on some of the more riskier items. They're going to go to safe bets, for example. Government bonds is one option that they may take. Next up, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear talks, some saying that nothing's going to come out of it, others saying that there are positive signs coming from it. For example, India readying to import Iranian oil. That's a positive sign. Also, the oil market itself seems to be responding to that positive news coming from the talks, where there's been a drop of $2 per barrel. If this happens, if the JCPOA happens, and if the sanctions are removed on Iran completely, which is what Iran has requested. Again, a wait-and-see game there. Then on to child poverty. In the UK, in particular in London, where it has the highest child poverty rate of any region in the UK. What is the percentage, you may ask? Let's take a look at what that says. 40% were living in poverty even before the pandemic. So obviously that's a huge problem for London, and that is the capital, so you can imagine what some other regions are going through.
The numbers are out. Israel's defeat at the hands of the resistance came with a cost. The economic cost for Israel over the course of the war is reported to be $37 million per day. Another source puts that figure at almost double, $61 million a day. Neither figure is good for Israel, which is trying to recover from a pandemic-hit economic recession. The war has decreased Israel's economic growth, especially coming out of a quarter that saw 6.5% contraction. Israel's economy was projected to grow between 5 and 7% this year on the heels of a rapid vaccination rollout. Because of the war, consumer and government spending and investment fell in the quarter, while exports rose. After all, how can business sentiment and investment remain high when Hamas rockets have reached areas in occupied Palestine that it had never reached before? Yet the key challenge facing Israel is how much unrest there will be in the occupied West Bank. For example, there was a one-day general strike in occupied Palestine. All businesses were shut. How many more of these shutdowns can Israel endure?
In this segment of the Q&A, we're going to talk about the BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction. This movement, which began years ago, has been very successful in its intention and in its goal. In this case, against Israel. There's been a number of products that have been boycotted as a result, products coming from Israel. It was responsible, after all, for the ending of the apartheid regime there in South Africa. But let's find out what our guests think about this. We're going to have the former UN Special Rapporteur Richard Falk rejoin us for this. Richard, the BDS movement has urged a military embargo on Israel, a boycott of firms who are complicit in Israel's occupation. It also is calling for the cancellation of academic, cultural and sporting events. Do you think there's enough momentum behind the call by the BDS to basically embargo Israel?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is different. How different is uncertain. but I do think that there will be a greater support, show of support around the world for the BDS campaign, and specifically favoring an arms embargo, and that will have some effect. And it will also, I think, have an effect on these normalization agreements that were reached in the last period of the Trump presidency, and gave Israel a certain political sense that they could ignore Palestinian grievances and still have benevolent relations with their Arab neighbors, and particularly the Gulf countries.
All right, Gilad, do you agree with Richard Falk in terms of what he said on the BDS?
Yeah, I am one of those guys who are actually very troubled by the BDS movement. I don't have any issues with economic boycott, but I think that this movement failed completely on that front. And instead of doing that, it actually worked intensively and extensively against freedom of speech.
The war on Gaza has ended. Well, you see, it has not. Why? Because, forget about the ceasefire. You can't have a ceasefire in a conflict that is over 60 years old. I mean, you can't have a ceasefire in an apartheid regime that has killed Palestinians, especially in the Gaza Strip. A war that appears to erupt every few years. So, what is the solution? Well, Palestinians need to prosper economically, for one thing. The occupied land, for another, needs to not be occupied or have an occupation regime execute its apartheid policies. That just can't happen. By the way, many of those violations are violations of human rights and even war crimes. Now, one solution? To have a referendum. A referendum to be held among the original Palestinians. This way, the governance issue at least can be solved, and most likely the rest is going to fall into place. And also, on the issue of the U.S. as a broker for a peace process, well, that just hasn't worked. The last time around, it was called the deal of the century. Where is that now? Gathering dust, along with one of its architects, Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, who called the Palestinian-Israeli issue, by the way, a real estate transaction issue. Palestinians need their homeland, period. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. Do send them to us. From Mikove Tavli and the entire team, it's goodbye until the next program.
Presidential election. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on 18th of June 2021. Regarding the sensitive role of the president in the Islamic Republic of Iran, it is necessary to qualify the nominees by the highest vetting body. According to Iran's constitution, the Guardian Council is responsible for this important job. It is mentioned in paragraph 9 of Article 110 of the constitution. Qualification of the presidential nominees with regards to the conditions that are mentioned in this law should be confirmed by the Guardian Council. The authority, which has been vested in the Guardian Council by Iran's constitution and the kind of duties that the body performs, means that this is one of the top bodies in the Islamic Republic of Iran. This body is very similar to many institutions in other countries which safeguard the constitution of those countries. In Germany, for instance, dealing with correction of elections, rejection of immunity, and dismissal of the lawmakers are amongst the duties of the House of Representatives. The Federal Court of Constitution is the highest court and among the most powerful institutions in Germany. In Bulgaria, too, according to paragraph 66 of the Constitution, wherever the accuracy of elections is doubted, the issue can be referred to the Court of Constitution. In Romania, Article 47 of the Constitution makes it clear that the Great National Assembly decides on accuracy or non-accuracy of election of every representative. This assembly examines the legality of every representative and makes decision on the accuracy or non-accuracy of this election. In Italy, the Italian Parliament is formed of the House of Representatives and the Senate. According to Article 66 of Italy's Constitution, each of these two Houses of Parliament will decide on the accuracy of the credentials of its members and the non-compliance or disqualification of the members for the job. In Canada, where the Canadian Parliament is composed of the House of Commons and the Senate, among the duties of the House of Commons are to change or modify the flexible parts of the Constitution, confirm the credentials